we're going to go forward and work with the state of Alaska about this lending to trust issue.
Governor Walker meets with tribes to discuss litigation over land into trust. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state budget cuts hit rural campuses hard.
All of the rural campuses were taking a little bigger cut because, as far as the college is concerned, the campuses are by far the largest expense.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Baby salmon live here, right in our backyards and neighborhoods. Go out, explore, and take the Baby Salmon Challenge. For more information, go to babysalmon.fish. This announcement is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Shell's Fenica icebreaker has returned to Alaska. It docked at Dutch Harbor last night after enduring repairs and protests in Portland, Oregon. Shell began drilling the top of a well in the Chukchi Sea last week, but it does not have federal permission to drill into oil-bearing rocks unless the Fenica is on site. Shell's well-capping stack sits on the stern of the Fenica. It's to be used in case a well blows out. The Fenica went to a Portland shipyard after tearing a 3-foot gash in its hull on a rock in Dutch Harbor. Climate change activists suspended from a bridge across Portland's Willamette River managed to delay the Fenica's departure by about 36 hours. Shell has until late September to finish its drilling for this year. Governor Bill Walker was in Akyechuk and Tuliksak yesterday to discuss a lawsuit involving tribal lands into trust, according to officials in Akyechuk. Walker's office kept his first visit to Southwest Alaska since his election low profile amid high interest in a case that could reshape jurisdiction on Alaska Native lands. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
Governor Walker arrived in Akyechuk around 10 a.m. and spent a couple hours meeting with tribal officials and community members before flying to Tuliksak. Philip Peter is chairman for the Akyechuk Indian Reorganization Act, or IRA Council, which opposes further delays.
The Akyechuk already won the case, and I said to them, we're not going to drop this issue. It's already been approved by the court.
The governor was traveling Wednesday on the North Slope, where he was talking with other tribes about trust lands and was unavailable for comment. Press Secretary Katie Marquette says Walker is reaching out to tribes like those in Southwest Alaska
to talk to them about lands into trust issues. He has additional meetings with other tribes across the state, in villages across the state, to continue talking about lands into trust issues.
The Department of the Interior last year announced new rules to allow Alaska tribes to put land into trust. Alaska Native leaders say the change, after years of litigation, brings them one step closer to self-determination. Trust status for tribal land protects it from taxation and alienation, the taking or sale of land, and gives tribes greater jurisdiction. Under the new rules, tribes could put land they own into trust, including land they've purchased, received through an inheritance, or lands transferred to tribes by Native corporations. The state has fought the issue for years. Governor Walker inherited a 2013 lawsuit from the Parnell administration. Most recently, Governor Walker asked earlier this year for a 6-month delay in the case. The state's not talking about its plans now, but Akyechuk officials say the governor wants another 6 months. Corey Mills, an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law, says the first 6-month extension ended in July. The state then received a 30-day extension and now faces a deadline of August 24th.
That's the deadline that's in place right now. Whether the state makes a different decision or wants to withdraw the appeal, that's yet to be seen and will be determined by August 24th and whatever is filed at that time.
The state can also ask for more time. After the meeting, described as a first for the community, Akyechuk's Philip Peter is hopeful that Governor Walker seems willing to work with them.
The governor is willing to work with the tribes about the land into trust issue. And I was saying to the governor that we're going to go forward and work with the state of Alaska about this land into trust issue.
Akyechuk and Tuliksak were plaintiffs in earlier litigation to allow trust lands in Alaska. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Deep cuts across the University of Alaska Fairbanks are spreading to satellite campuses across the state, and NOAM's Northwest Campus is no exception. UAF is facing a larger cut for the upcoming year than had been previously expected, in all a reduction of $31.4 million. Increasing operating costs, paying off debts, and compensation increases all mean UAF will be $20 million short. And to make up the difference, cuts are happening across the board. Northwest Campus Director Bob Metcalf says, for the most part, classes and degree programs are safe. But especially for rural campuses, they'll feel the sting, mostly in fixed costs like personnel and facilities.
All of the rural campuses were taking a little bigger cut because, as far as the college is concerned, the College of Rural and Community Development, the campuses are by far the largest expense.
It's a roughly $200,000 bite into the NOAM campus budget. That means further reductions in travel and contract services and leaving some unfilled jobs empty. Metcalf says the newly refurbished Emily Ivanoff Brown Student Resource Center and Library will be left without a library technician to run it.
It was tough, but we purposely kept the library position vacant because we knew this was going to happen. We won't have anyone to actually provide any library services. That's one of the most painful ones for me. I would say mothballing is probably the best way to describe it.
Metcalf himself isn't immune to the cuts. He says he and other administrators face unpaid furloughs this year, but it doesn't mean he'll work any less. He thinks it's just the beginning of furloughs for employees across the UAF system. Amid the cuts, Northwest Campus is also making an investment. An unexpected city land auction in December saw UAF officials dig into the university savings to buy the plots of land the campus has, until now, been renting at a cost of about $450,000. Though the sale isn't fully complete, Metcalf says it's a little easier to face the cuts, knowing UAF has a long-term investment in NOAM's campus.
The sale was approved, obviously, by the Board of Regents and the whole way up to the very top. So it does signify a major support for the university here in our region.
The fall semester at Northwest Campus starts on September 3rd. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new book catalogs the history of an Aleutic village on Kodiak Island.
They collected the more resilient items like the wood masks and the baskets. I mean, it's just amazing the types of things that survive.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
There's been a big decrease in the number of gonorrhea cases in Southwest Alaska over the last 5 years, according to the State Department of Health. It comes after local doctors tried a new strategy called expedited partner therapy. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has the story.
When he moved to Bethel to take a job as an OBGYN at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation in 2009, Dr. David Compton learned the region was having an outbreak of the sexually transmitted infection gonorrhea.
I found out that not only did we have a very high baseline rate of sexually transmitted infections, gonorrhea and chlamydia, but we were seeing what we discovered to be was an epidemic of gonorrhea that the CDC was very concerned about, and we were very concerned could develop into epidemics of other sexually transmitted diseases like HIV.
Until 2008, gonorrhea infection rates in Alaska were very low, but in 2009, they detected an uptick everywhere and called it an outbreak across the state. If left untreated in women, the bacterial infection can result in pelvic inflammatory disease and serious pregnancy complications. It can lead to infertility in both women and men. Young people 15 to 29 are more likely to be infected by gonorrhea because of their sexual behaviors. Alaska Natives are disproportionately affected. The Centers for Disease Control and the state suggested something called expedited partner therapy. That's where, instead of tracking down partners of infected people and trying to get them to come in for treatment separately, the doctor prescribes or gives the medication to the patient to pass on to their partners. It took months, Compton says, to convince everybody involved it was a good idea. They had to switch from the recommended medication, which is a shot, to a pill, Compton says, in order to make it easier to deliver the medication. But it worked.
What we found when we tried this was that the partners were treated up to 3 days faster, and therefore they had sex with fewer people with the infection, and we were able to decrease the rate of the gonorrhea.
By a lot. They reduced new infections by 48% in the southwest region of the state over the past 5 years. They also reduced the duration of test to treatment time for the STI from nearly a week to just 2 or 3 days. Now expedited partner therapy has become routine at YKHC in Bethel. It's also available at village clinics and at the public health office. That's something Susan Jones, who works for the state HIV-STD program, says was critical to getting the outbreak under control. Now it's becoming more available throughout Alaska, she says.
It's something that has expanded across the state in varying degrees. One of the things that's helped this along is that the physicians in the state changed their regulations that allowed them to do prescriptions for individuals exposed to STDs, and it's now a lawful thing to do that. You don't have to see the person, but you can write a prescription if they've been exposed to gonorrhea.
Jones says, although the decrease in YK Delta gonorrhea is hopeful, it's recently come to light that some is being missed in the routine urine test, so it's important to ask providers about additional testing in some cases. And although gonorrhea is down overall in the region, Jones says the southwest area, along with northern Alaska, still has the highest rates of gonorrhea in the state, and Alaska ranks number 4 in the nation for the STI. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Earlier this summer, paleontologists confirmed that fossilized vertebrae found in the Talkeetna Mountains belong to an ancient sea creature, the elasmosaur. This is the first time remains of the species have been found in the state. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
The elasmosaur was a carnivorous reptile that prowled the oceans during the Cretaceous period, which ended about 65 million years ago. Pat Druckenmiller is the Earth Sciences Curator at the University of Alaska's Museum of the North. As he explains, the most striking feature of the elasmosaur was its incredibly long neck.
Imagine an animal maybe 30 feet long, with half of that length being its neck, and this long neck sticking out, supporting a relatively small head at the end.
Based purely on description, the elasmosaur can be hard to picture in the imagination. Druckenmiller says there is one good visual comparison.
And although I'm a little bit loath to use the comparison, if you picture the Loch Ness Monster, which is definitely a mythical animal, that mythical animal was basically based on the body plan of an elasmosaur.
With elasmosaur's neck taking up as much as half of its total body length, it had to serve some evolutionary advantage. Pat Druckenmiller says scientists don't agree on what exactly that advantage was nearly 150 years after the first elasmosaur was discovered.
Well, that's a million-dollar question, and frankly, that's defied any widely accepted answer.
Druckenmiller says there are plenty of theories that try to explain the purpose of elasmosaur's extreme anatomy. Many of them deal with feeding. Pat thinks that there are other possibilities as well, however.
One idea I like, actually, is that sometimes animals have very strange anatomy because they use them for sexual selection. In other words, showing off to potential mates and just species recognition. So that's also a possibility.
While scientists continue to work on a consensus on elasmosaur's neck, the other question I wanted the answer to was how an animal that lived in the ocean found itself millions of years later buried in a cliff at over 4,000 feet of elevation. Pat Druckenmiller says finding marine fossils at elevation isn't uncommon.
Alaska looked very different, and in fact, these rocks, which were being laid down as sediment below sea level, were along the southern margin of what was Alaska then, and in the last 70 million years then, because of movements of the Pacific seafloor under Alaska, they've been crunched and brought up above sea level.
Druckenmiller says that a great deal of the credit for the find should go to Kirvin Metzler, the Anchorage resident who first noticed the bones eroding out of a cliff in the Talkeetna Mountains and called the Museum of the North.
My hat's off to somebody who, you know, does what I would say is the right thing in the situation and reports insignificant finds like that to the museum so we can study it and share it with the rest of the world.
Pat Druckenmiller believes that a large portion of the elasmosaur's skeleton is fossilized in the mountain, and he and his team will continue their work to extract it next summer. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Bering Straits Native Corporation is getting into the hardware business after purchasing Alaska Industrial Hardware, a small Alaska-based chain of industrial construction and equipment stores. Founded by James Thompson in 1959 in a Quonset hut in Midtown Anchorage, AIH now operates 8 locations statewide, including 3 in Anchorage, with stores in Eagle River, Wasilla, and Kenai. Outside of South Central, the company also has stores in Fairbanks and Juneau. Details of the sale, including the purchase price for the company, were not disclosed. But as of a 2008 profile in Alaska Business Monthly, AIH boasts a $15 million on-hand inventory in its stores. AIH President Terry Shurtleff says those numbers are higher today, and the company's distribution network connects it to 400 retailers across Alaska, including the bush.
They're buying hardware in Western Alaska. Odds are the vendor who has it has purchased it through our wholesale division.
In a release from BSNC, Corporation President and CEO Gail Schubert says AIH is a solid company that fits well with the growing Bering Straits portfolio of companies. Shurtleff and the existing executive team will continue managing the company and its more than 230 employees on a day-to-day basis. No major changes in staffing are expected as a result of the purchase.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
One Kodiak Island settlement has served as both a rich archaeological resource and fueled the Aleutic Heritage Renaissance now underway in Kodiak. The Aleutic Museum and Archaeological Repository recently published a book called Kalunik with the University of Alaska Press. The nearly 400-page volume focuses on archaeological discoveries near the community of Karluk and delves into the site's lasting effects on those involved. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
The Aleutic Museum's Director of Research and Publication, Amy Steffian, says the site at the mouth of the Karluk River, Karluk I, opened to excavation in 1983 when few people knew about Kodiak Island's Aleutic history.
Many people would not even claim their native heritage because there was so much disenfranchisement and disrespect. And there was this sense that the prehistoric culture that had preceded the people that live today was impoverished, that these were poor people who suffered and who didn't have a vibrant artistic life. And certainly when we set out to study this site, it became pretty clear that that was false.
Steffian says it became extremely exciting to the Aleutic community to see the objects coming out of the ground and have access to them. She says sharing that was the second part of the book.
It's really two stories. It's the story of the site and its contents, and it provides an ethnography. It talks about how people lived 600 years ago, 400 years ago in that time period. But it also tells how this kind of anthropological, archaeological study, when done in partnership with a community, when done with support and involvement, can be a very powerful experience.
She explains that the museum worked with many contributors on Kalunik, from researchers to people who had excavated on the site.
And also with members of the community who'd cared for the collection in the museum as volunteers or as paid employees. And we ask everybody to write about 1,000 words that summarize their experience so that we could tell the story not only of the site and its history, but of the impact of this research on the community broadly.
And she says they've built a picture about Aleutic life using a variety of resources, from oral history to Russian texts. As far as the artifacts go, they stand out for being especially well-preserved. Executive Director April Lactonen Counselor explains the fresh water that leaked into the site helped prevent oxygen from touching the artifacts until excavators could unearth them.
Thinking about a 500-year-old house where the grass that they used to keep the floor dry and clean still being green, and then within just a couple of hours, the oxidation happening. Of course, they didn't collect probably the dirt and the grass, but they collected the more resilient items like the wood masks and the baskets. I mean, it's just amazing the types of things that survive.
Counselor says she was involved in the project through the Kodiak Aleutic New Words Council, which draws on the knowledge of Aleutic elders. She says the members who had helped create words for modern technology turned their attention to ancient objects.
By creating words for items where the words were once lost, we were able to kind of put our mark back on that prehistory and say, this is our prehistory. Our people have long been discussed by outside archaeologists, anthropologists. For the elders, it was really important to claim ownership over the past by giving back new words to those old items.
Here are a couple of examples.
Ayakum ahunachta, the thing for making the harpoon have heaviness.
And also
Nuzik, which is the modern word for a knife, and they also applied it to the ancient knife. That helps show the cultural continuity that we don't need to come up with a completely unrelated word. We can use an existing word so that people can leverage the language they already have.
Counselor says there are many more words listed in the book. Kalunik stands out as a thorough study of Aleutic culture, and as Stefian says, the goal was to make it a joint project where everyone was involved and people of all heritages and interests had access to the material. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Ketchikan's newest totem pole arrived with a massive crowd on Saturday in front of the Vigor Shipyard. It's the first totem pole raised in about 2 years, and tribal and non-tribal community members alike cheered as it came through the crowd. KRBD's Madeline Beck was there.
This was the sound of the totem pole being brought from the Vigor warehouse on Saturday to its current prominent position just off Tongass Avenue. Hundreds showed up from around town and neighboring communities, including highly regarded members of local tribes and Vigor representatives. Vigor General Manager Mark Pearson says the idea to carve a totem pole for the shipyard came in the winter of 2013. Pearson says that Vigor members wanted to have more Native art to show the connection between the company and its community.
So it has to be an expression of our willingness to do more for the community and to include all of the community. Anytime we're exclusionary or anytime we're insensitive to the differences in people, we limit ourselves.
Former Ketchikan Indian community member Willie Jackson described what the pole itself symbolized.
Looking at the pole, you're going to see the raven on top. You're going to see the strong man right underneath that raven. You're going to see the eagle, but you're also going to see the woman at the very base of the pole, which is the strength of who we really are as a matriarch society.
Vigor CEO Frank Fody came from Portland for the ceremony and says that he wants his company to connect with all people, making sure natives and women were included.
Vigor means effort, energy, good health, renewal. It's part of who we are. My color today is pink, and part of it is to bring some of the feminine energy into what we do. We have a tremendous group of men and women that are part of what we do. To you, I say, Hawa, Doixin, Gunashish.
After much struggle to raise the pole with manpower alone, a group of about a dozen people pushed, pulled, and heaved the structure into place. After the new pole was in place, the celebrating continued up at the Ted Ferry Civic Center. There was food, singing, and hours of dancing, along with gifts for those who had made the pole raising possible. Metlakatla's mayor, Audrey Hudson, came forward to show her appreciation to those who put so much effort into the raising of this particular totem pole. She was especially grateful for the carver who brought the pole to life.
I feel blessed to have witnessed the raising of a new totem pole today. Totem poles are a powerful symbol for both our peoples.
Many tribal leaders gave Bodhi gifts that night, including a hand-carved paddle, abalone inlaid hummingbird bath, and a new nickname, Chief. Fodi thanked everyone for their help, especially tribal members who taught him about the culture and the land surrounding his Ketchikan shipyard. And then, as the opening remarks drew to a close, it was time for song and dance, lasting late into the night. Reporting from Ketchikan, I'm Madeline Beck.
Someone has dumped drums of hazardous waste in the Buskin River State Park on Kodiak Island. That's according to Preston Cruz, an Alaska State Park ranger, who says they discovered two 55-gallon containers last month.
Either sometime over the night on July 12th or early morning, July 13th, a couple of barrels were dumped along the Buskin River, approximately 80 feet from the river, and they contained what originally we thought was just diesel fuel. And it turned out to be like diesel salt water, more consistent with what would have been from emptying a vessel's bilge.
Cruz says some of the drums spilled and required cleanup. There have been more tossed around the island.
The ranger investigating it also had determined that around the Kodiak burrow, there had been an additional 18 other barrels kind of in the same timeline dumped. And we're kind of going under the assumption that they were all probably from the same subject that was doing all the dumping.
He says park rangers are uncertain about the motivation behind the illegal disposal. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from John Ryan in Unalaska, Ben Matheson and Dacia Eaton in Bethel, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Matthew Smith in Nome, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Madeline Beck in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The University of Alaska Southeast School of Management offers online college degrees for the unconventional student or working professional who wants learning on their schedule and timeline. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.